Buckle up and settle in for a full hour of automotive mayhem with the real car guy, master technician, Mark Salem, where the only two things we can't fix is a broken heart and the crack of dawn. To talk to Mark, call 602-508-0960. That's 602-508-0960. Now, once again, here's Mark. Rolled up to my
Chevrolet. Well, good morning, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem. And today is special because we're broadcasting live at Kurtz Auto Repair, which is I-17 and Bell. Actually, you go a little bit east of the I-17 and Bell, and then you turn north on 23rd. So if you come up in that area, you get off of Bell Road, you head east, go to 23rd Avenue, and then you go north. And so we're here at Kurtz, and Kurtz staff is here. We're not working on cars, but we're here to talk to you. You're welcome to come by. They have actually some food.
Yep.
And Eric is going to do a table dance a little later on, I understand.
I hope not. With a pole.
With the pole, okay. And it's going to be pretty exciting here. And nevertheless, let me tell you about another good repair shop, but it's on the other side of town. Thompson's Auto Repair has been in our best car repair list for years and years and years, just like Kurtz has. Since 1970, Thompson's Auto Repair has been providing great service, great light truck repair, great maintenance service, good diagnostic service to their people in Mesa. They're the only shop in Mesa that is certified by Mark Salem. They have ASE certified technicians. They're there to provide you with the highest level of automotive service, followed with friendly reminders that let you know when your vehicle is due for service. It's never been easier or more convenient to keep your vehicle in tip-top shape than unless you go to Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing on Main Street, just east of Stapley on the south side of the road. Main Street, just east of Stapley on the south side of the road. So, got here some guy sitting next to me.
Uh-oh.
And his name is Eric. And, Eric, why don't you tell people what you do here at Kurtz Auto Repair other than nothing?
Well, that depends who you ask.
Nothing.
All right. Okay. So we have to, we need more than nothing, okay? So tell us, Monday through Friday, when you write it down on your resume for the bank when you borrow money, what is it you tell them you do?
I'm the shop foreman. I actually oversee most of the guys and try to hit up all the head diagnostics and everything.
Okay. So you have certification, I understand?
I have tons of certification, yes. All the AAC Master Certs. The advanced L1, L2, 3, which is your diagnostics for the electronics, your diesels, and your hybrid.
Okay. Now, Jeff is the service manager.
Yes.
Okay. And what kind of certifications can we talk about him? Does he stand up to the Eric certification level?
He doesn't know as much on the diagnostics as I do, and he probably hasn't proved he can do it because he's let all the certifications expire.
Oh, so now it's time to throw him under the bus. Boy, you're going to be in really big trouble for that. But up here at Kurtz, you handle the shop. Eric
yes.
handles the shop. So Eric is the one that is supposed to manage the shop, help with the diagnosis, ensure that the repair is correct, and so forth and so on. But you really do work on cars as well.
Unfortunately, yes, you'll see me under the hood, taking your instrument panel out, things like that. I do the tedious stuff usually.
Okay. When it comes to younger techs, junior techs, do you oftentimes follow the diagnostic process with them and then leave them to do the repair?
I will. I'll walk them through, show them why I'm doing what I'm doing, and then say, hey, go ahead and change this part. You can do that.
Okay. And the youngsters that you got, the young men that you have, do they have any certifications, or are they basically kind of an assistant to senior guys?
We got two young guys right now that are high schools. They don't have any certification. We're working on them. We plan to have them up in full certifications in a few years. Then we do have some 30-ish guys that do have full certifications that are still learning a bunch.
As I imagine, in most shops, we have a series of levels of technicians. We have the masters, and then we have the R&R guys. And then we have the light-duty guys, and then the oil change guys.
Yeah.
Similar?
Similar. We do a pretty good crossbred. We like to certify all of our guys, so all of our head guys right now are certified. We do have a lube tech that we're working to get some maintenance certification on, and then we have the two helpers that we're just starting on.
Okay. All right, and how long have you been here at Kurtz?
That is a loaded question, but 17 years.
17 years. So you started when you were about 10?
Well, I'm not quite that young. No, I started when I was 18.
And Jeff, you and Jeff are related in some fashion.
I married Kurt's wife. Kurt's wife. Wow, that's bad. Yeah. Kurt's daughter. And Jeff is his nephew. So through marriage, yes, we are a little related.
Okay. So you guys get along good, or you want to tell us anything that we should know specifically about Jeff?
No, we get along pretty good. He can be cranky, but I think he gets that from the rock side.
The rock side. Okay. So we should probably ask Kurt about that.
Yeah, you might need to ask him about that.
Well, honoriness is not anything that we're short of here at this facility, I can tell you that much. 602-508-0960. If you'd like to join us, you can. 602-508-0960. We're here live at Kurt's Auto, 23rd Avenue in Bell. And we're on the north side of the road, and you'll see lots of cars and trucks, and you're welcome to stop by. We had some radio issues, and so we're actually doing the show over the phone. We're going to do the very best we can and can kind of control the volume back and forth between Eric and I and Jeff and I and Kurt and I. But has anything really got you lately with respect to a diagnostic to where you had a car that came in with a real strange problem, and like the rest of us, you kind of circle around the car two or three times, and then when you finally fix it, you hit yourself in the forehead and you go, way to go. Now, is that something you can admit in front of all these people?
Yes, I'll admit it, because if I don't admit it, then I shouldn't be on this planet. Okay. But, yeah, there are several things. I've got a Jaguar that I'm dealing with that's intermittently no crank, elusive communication. The problem is the communication data through the whole system, when you got to find out is whether it's a module shorting out intermittently or whether there's a line shorting out intermittently, it's beating me up right now.
Okay. So this Jaguar has intermittent no start, no click, no thunk, no nothing. But how about the rest of the power system? Does it have headlights and does it have a horn?
Oh, yeah. Everything works perfect. It's just when you go to hit the key, nothing happens. It just says, and then on the dash it tells you, you know, no DSE, which is their traction control. Okay. So, yeah, it's a communication problem. So it doesn't do anything.
Okay, so this isn't something as simple as we know that we've got 12 volts to the key. We know that when we go to start, we're going to go through the park neutral switch. Ultimately, we're going to end up with the starter solenoid that's going to make the starter happen. Mm-hmm. It's not something there.
No, because what happens is these are so integrated that the park neutral switch, it communicates with the transmission module, which controls the engine module, which then decides to start the car if all of those circuits test good. So it can be anything along that whole line, plus the communication, plus the power interrupt in any one of those multiple modules.
Now, is there an actual park neutral switch?
Yes, there is.
Okay. Why not just bypass that thing for one of your tests?
Well, the problem is if that was the problem, I wouldn't lose communication between other modules. I'm getting communication problems between multiple modules.
So the park neutral switch can talk to the transmission controller, but the problem is the chain between the transmission controller and the ECM has lost.
Yeah.
So the engine doesn't know to add fuel or spark, so even if it was cranking, chances are it wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Okay, this is one of those cars I think that probably down the road it deserves a 5-gallon gas in the back seat and a road flare.
Well, the customer had decided to try to go trade it in and then didn't make it out of the parking lot. So they said, well, we're just going to leave it and let you fix it.
And what year and model Jag is that? Do you remember?
The mid-2000s.
Okay. So it is an XJR or XJ or anything?
No, it's nothing special. It's just the regular rest type that you see every day driving down the road.
It looks kind of like a Ford.
A lot like a Ford.
Acts like a Ford?
Even worse.
So, but actually the early 2000 Jaguars, especially the X models, they have lots of Ford everything in them, and we've actually, my wife's owned one, not me, but she did, and it actually worked pretty good, and it was a good car. But the small look-alike Jaguars, their S series, that looks like Ford and acts like Ford is a whole different animal.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's still Jaguar on it, so then you end up buying a lot of your Jaguar parts, even though it does Ford powertrain in it, but it still has the Jaguar name, so the things that are specific to it, you still can't buy from Ford, so you still end up paying a pretty penny for repairing those things.
And it's not like you can just go into an O'Reilly's or a AutoZone or a
Pep Boys and just buy a module for your Jaguar, much less anything else?
No, and they'll try to sell you one. I know they will, because we've had people throw all kinds of parts on and finally bring them to us after they spent hundreds of dollars and fix it, right, for a few dollars.
That happens a lot. I got an email this morning from a guy with a Dakota truck, and intermittently it just dies, the idling. He's got the 4.6, I think the 4.47 or 5.2 maybe, and he's probably got a throttle body in it because it's an older model. And we were talking about idle air control motor and talking about just putting your hands on it and listening to it and feeling it. But then I reminded him that your hands have to be educated. So you have to know how it's supposed to feel as it goes in and out, as the idle air control motor controls the air passageway and the air to the motor. So you have to know what you're feeling. So, I mean, you could go buy one if you wanted to and plug it in and see what it is. But there was some other advice I gave him. And it's advice that we get the do-it-yourselfer that's dealing with the throttle body, and then they bring it in, and everything's messed up. So what is the advice I should have given him with respect to the throttle body?
Probably said you probably need to take it and have it looked at professionally, because we are just throwing parts at it until we really know what's going on.
You're correct. Most people do that. But what I told him was that there's lots of adjustment screws on that throttle body, and none of those are going to make any difference in the problem he has.
No, because everything's computer-controlled, and so the computer has a base place it wants to be. If you mess with it, then it really doesn't know what it wants to do.
And I explained to him the value of the synchronization of the TPS, the idle air control motor, and the base idle. And I told him we have to keep all of those, so don't touch any of those screws. It's really a matter of just being able to understand what you're supposed to do. 602-508-0960. That's the phone number if you'd like to chime in, 602-508-0960. Eric and I are here to help you with your question. It's not likely we're going to be able to fix your car, but I did have another call, and a lady has an air conditioning problem, intermittent no fan on a Honda. And I taught her how to take a hammer handle and hit the back of the fan.
And that works sometimes, and believe it or not, that's sometimes our diagnostics.
Well, and if she successfully hits the fan every time it doesn't work and it turns on, hasn't she saved herself a bunch of money in diagnostic time?
Yeah, basically, you told me that the thing always got power and it's commanding on, and basically there's something binding in the motor, so when you jar it, it decides to start spinning.
Or the brushes are worn down to nothing, yeah, and we're hitting the brushes back down on the armature. Okay, 602-508-0960. Eric and Mark, it's going to be Eric and Kurt, and then are we going to let Jeff talk?
We might.
Okay. All right. Is he dressed today, or is he still wearing that skirt?
Well, he looks a little famished, so we'll see.
Famished is a good word. That's a nice word. All right, we'll be back right after this. Well, welcome back, everybody. My name is Mark Salem, and we're here at Kurt's Automotive on Bell and I-17 on the northeast corner. Actually, you go east just about a half a block, and you go north on 23rd Avenue. And we're right here talking about cars and car repair. You can stop by. You can talk to Jeff and Eric and Kurt and I about a particular car problem that you have. We're welcome to do that. One of us has to stay on the air, but the rest of us can mess around. We're trying to get Kurt to take over the shop, but he's probably going to have a tough time hitting the brakes to the second.
To the second?
To the second.
Second, what?
Well, to the second. Otherwise, when you take a break and they want it at 58:50, it's 58 minutes after the hour.
Yeah. Yeah, he would have a hard time with that.
How about you?
I don't want to be in that position either. You're good.
All right. Well, this portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by S&S Tire. They opened up in 1976, and they have three locations in the North and West Valley to serve you. They have Peoria, Surprise, and Goodyear. S&S has a complete line of tires and many different brands of each tires and all the sizes. So you can take your car in there, and they'll grab the size off your tire, and they can give you a good, better, best estimate that's an out-the-door estimate. So it's going to have the tires, the FET, the sales tax, all the shop supplies, everything. It's a how much you write your check for before you leave home. So S&S Tire is a place and a warehouse that has huge tire inventory, so you're not just stuck with one brand. They also have tires for your farm equipment, your golf equipment, your lawn and garden equipment, your ATVs, your trailers, plus they have commercial and construction tires. So they're going to balance your tires, and they'll do alignments, and they do suspension work. So if you're looking for new tires on anything you own, visit S&S Tire Locations, one of the three in the West Valley. So have you got any cars that have really kicked your butt lately, Eric?
Yeah, well, we talked about the Jag right before the break, but let's move on to, let's see. Well, the problem is we happen to be the shop that everybody brings their place thing to if somebody else can't fix it. So I deal with a lot of these headaches. Fortunately, most of them aren't that bad. It's just people don't know what they're doing. So
it's not the customer that doesn't know what he's doing. No. Perhaps it might be an inexperienced technician that had an opportunity or was placed in front of this car that he really didn't have the fundamentals down.
Right. I wasn't trying to bash anybody, but unfortunately we've got an old Nissan Sentra that's given us a little bit of a fit that doesn't make much of a sense. It was running just a tad rich without an O2 sensor working. We put an O2 sensor in it, and it goes extremely rich, so I'm beating my head a little bit right now, figuring out what's flying to who and trying to figure out, especially since it's an 88 and there's no data, and I've got to pin test everything.
Okay, so I have one for you. We had an old Chevy pickup truck, and it had a throttle body, and so it had one O2 sensor. And the problem was is when you'd start it up, it'd idle up high, and then it would just start trimming back the idle, and you could watch the fuel system shutting off fuel, and the on time of the injectors got smaller and smaller and smaller, and then it would die. So it was just trimming out the fuel. So when you looked at it with the scanner, it was screaming rich, 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 rich. So the O2 sensor was screaming rich. So we're like everybody else. Let's just stick an O2 sensor in there and see if it's better. It isn't better. It isn't even an iota better. It isn't even close. So we take the O2 sensor back out, and we measure both of them with a digital voltometer. What should they have? What should they talk?
You mean baseline or
yep.
4.5 volts or so?
Okay. All right. Now, this is an old Chevy, so it's going to be 1 millivolt on the top end.
Yep.
You're talking Chryslers that are higher. But you hit the nail on the head accidentally because this thing, for whatever reason, had 6 volts somewhere attached to that output side of the O2 sensor. So the computer is only used to seeing 0.1 to 10,
yeah.
So 1 to 10. And the computer is seeing 60. And it doesn't know what to do, so it keeps trimming back the fuel, thinking we're running rich, and it trims it till it dies. This truck came in with more than $1,000 worth of work on it, more than $1,000. Now, admittedly, it took us 3 hours to figure this out. What we decided to do was rather than try to figure out between the ECM and the O2 sensor where the problem was, we just cut the trigger wire or the talk wire to the O2 sensor. We ran a 20-foot wire to the ECM. We cut it. So we took it right to it. It worked perfectly. So at that point, we're not going to go in and find out where this 6-volt crossover is at. We're going to abandon that line, and we're going to run a new line and a new loom from the O2 sensor to the PCM. Has that ever happened to you where you've had to redesign a car?
It happens very commonly, especially the older Dodges where they mount the Cummins controller on the side of the block. They get a lot of interference on the throttle position, and they'll kick transmission gears, they'll flare fuel and torque convert. They do all that. So, yeah, running extra wires, bypassing what they built is very common. And Chrysler even knows that there's a problem because they put bulletins out and said, hey, if you got this problem, just do it this way.
So they're actually giving you the idea of wiring around an existing circuit. But basically all you're doing is you're just jumping around the bad wire, the bad connection, or the interference.
Yes. It's very common. I wouldn't say we do it all the time, but it is enough problem that we see it commonly.
Probably, like us, maybe once a month you see it?
I would say yes. And most of the time, fortunately, connection problems are at bends and things like that, and most of the time easy to get to. If it's in the middle of a harness that's buried underneath an intake manifold, I bypass those. If it's something I can fix within 2 hours and keep the factory harness, I like doing it that way.
And I agree with you. In this particular truck, 4-wheel drive, the O2 goes into the transmission harness. That goes up over the bell, top of the bell housing, then up to the back of the firewall. Then it goes into the firewall for the ECM. So we just thought, we aren't going to do that. Now, this is like a 76 or 77 Chevy truck. He's already got a lot of money into it, so we're trying to trim back that as much as possible. But the bottom line is we've never seen 6 volts in an O2 sensor circuit. Why wouldn't it be 12 volts? Because the entire truck is a 12-volt system, the entire truck. So where would 6 volts come from? On a 70 model or early 80 model Chevy pickup?
Well, what would come to mind would be like the voltage reducer for the coils, if you're on the backside of that or something, because some of those coils were running lower voltages, so they didn't hiccup or sputter when you would turn on headlights because you get a voltage drop or things like that. So that, or you got just a barely like one on one wire, because each wire is actually a strand of 20 or 30 wires. You got one or two of those little wires touching, and so you have resistance between the connections so you don't get the full 12-volt passover.
Okay. Well, it's a two-wire O2 sensor, so we got one ground, right?
Yeah.
And the O2 sensor is a generator of signal.
Yeah.
So it's only generated 1 millivolt, mm-hmm. right? So where did we get 6 volts upstream? You know what I mean?
From another wire somewhere in that harness. We just don't know where.
And that's the reason why we decided to just wire around it.
Yeah.
And we told him we were going to do that. We told him we're going to wire around it, and we know it'll work because we already ran it. He goes, well, how did you run the wire? And I said, well, we ran 20 feet. We went from the O2 sensor down on the ground, around the hood, plugged it through the firewall, and grabbed the ECM, and we knew which wire that was. So we cut it where we could put it back together if we had to, because how many times have you cut a wire too short, and then you can't put a connector on it, and then you have to go back and fix it?
Well, I don't like cutting them short, so I try not to do that one. It's happened a few times. More than likely, if you're trying to fix a wire, they break right at a connector, and so that ends up being more of a problem.
But, folks, what he's not saying is he learned that by cutting them too short. So he's dancing. He looks like Fred Astaire over here. 602-508-0960. If you'd like a car question answered, that's the time, that's the phone number, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back.
About
that demon, automobile, the metal monster with the polyglass wheels and 34 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. I'm Mark Salem. We're up here at Kurtz Automotive, and we're doing a live remote here. We were going to use some sophisticated equipment, but we just couldn't. We couldn't figure out. And you got a bunch of car guys trying to figure out something sophisticated, and we just didn't do a very good job. So if you want to somehow connect some satellite in outer space, we are not the people that you should hire. We are not going to be able to pull that off. We can talk to the computer on your car, but we can't talk to the computer at the radio station, so we're doing it by phone. Eric, the service manager, is here. He works at Kurtz. He's been a great help to many other technicians because he really does know his skill and his trade pretty good. I think the diagnostic part of our business is probably the worst part, but it's probably the most gratifying, yes or no?
I would believe it is the worst part, because you're going in there blindly and you're trying to find a problem where you don't know. Basically, you got to test the system, whether it's fail, pass, or fail, and you keep moving down the line until you find the failure problem. So, yeah, it's nice when you finally figure out a hard one, especially if it's been to another shop and they say, we can't figure this thing out, please help us. That's really nice. So, yeah, I would say it's got its ups and downs.
So, but when you're doing diagnostics, how important is the customer's conversation with you? And we're not here to beat up customers, but in reality, that's so important. Because somebody came in the other day and said to us, my husband wants you to align our car. And we said, well, tell us what's going on. She says, I don't know. So we aligned the car. And a couple of days later, he comes in with his butt on fire, and he says, you know, you didn't fix it. And I said, fix what? You said, you told your wife to have us align the car. So I took a ride with them. So one of the rear tires had a tread separation, so there's a significant vibration on the back of the car. And he asked me what was probably a fair question in his mind, why didn't you find that in the alignment? And my response was, "Is you had us working on the wrong end of the car. The vibration's in the back of the car, and you wanted us to align the front tires." He had another issue where he wanted us to tune it up. And we told her the plugs were fresh. We didn't really feel like that was an issue. And he said, well, you didn't fix the idle either. And I said, well, we were told to tune it up. We didn't know there was an idle problem. So I said, well, let's go take a ride. So we take a ride, and I find the vibration. and the vibration is in the seat of my pants, so I know it's in the back of the car. As we're driving along, the car goes like this. It does that. All right, it's June. I'm going to spot you. It's June. What is it, big dog?
That would probably be your AC compressor cycling and the load on the engine changing its pitch.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. So I reached over and I turned the air off and it stopped doing it. And I go, there, I just fixed it for you. He says, that's not exactly the fix I want because it's June.
Yeah.
And I said, I know, but you need just refrigerant.
Yeah.
All right. Have you heard about the new refrigerant?
The R1234?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's got its explosive personality. So, yeah, a lot of the manufacturers that went to it, GM and Mercedes especially, have went back away from it because they found that under certain circumstances, it can cause an explosion.
Okay, it's marginally flammable. Marginally flammable, all right? The chances of it catching your car on fire is the same as getting struck by lightning.
Yeah.
Okay, but here's the real important part of the two refrigerants. Okay, the R1234. When it goes into the atmosphere, it's gone in 8 hours. R12, R22, and R134 take 120 years to dissipate in the atmosphere. Now, it is true the newer model cars are going to beef up their evaporator box, because they don't want anything to happen. And I think so many of them are moving the evaporator outside the cabin of the car, but it's just marginally. So what marginally means to me is you're going to have to work hard to set it on fire. But just like you and just like me, we're all going to try. We're all going to see.
And we've all seen it.
Yeah. And we've all seen fuel fires and all that other kind of stuff. Okay, we got a caller real quick. Let's go to the caller.
Name's Vicky.
Vicky, good morning.
Good morning. How the heck are you?
I'm better than the average bear.
My husband has a 2008 Colorado, which I really like, except for it has that security thing with the key, I guess, is what we've been told, where 12 times out of 13, it starts just fine. You know, you drive up to the store, you go in, buy whatever you got, buy, get back in, it starts right up. And then time number 13, you have to wait 10 minutes before it'll start. And we were told it has something to do with the key, so I went to a key shop and hit, but they said were like factory specified keys made. And it didn't seem to help. It seems to work if you use the same key all the time. It seems to work most of the time. But is there a fix for that? Because from what I read on the Internet, it's a security problem with this vehicle.
Okay. Well, she's got an 08 Colorado, and she's got a security problem. Intermittently, it won't start. But do you know that they have the lead on any of the security issues above and beyond about 20 other makes, models, and years?
No, I mean, the problem typically is a communication between the keys or the sensing module for the security to the ECM some type.
And what he's talking about, what we're talking about is we've got a key that needs to talk to the ignition switch, and the ignition switch needs to talk to the security module, which then lets the car start and run. So, and she did say, and I'm interpreting for this for you, just you can't hear her call, she did say that it seems to work better with one key than the other key. And if that's the case, it would seem to me it would be the battery in the key or just the key. But it's going to cost her $125 to $185 to have a new key cut for that car. Then we're going to have to go in and reprogram the computer to let it know that we've added a key.
Okay, this is not one with a chip.
Okay. So is it an aftermarket security company or security system if it doesn't have a chip in the key?
No, this is just what they call it on the Internet, a part of the security thing for the truck.
Okay. She says it doesn't have a chip in the key. Yeah. Yeah, we're kind of confused, but of course we're working on stuff that you've been told by other people, and that's a difficult situation. When you say it doesn't start and you have to wait 10 minutes, I'm thinking it doesn't crank.
Right.
Okay, so does it crank and die, or does it just not go rrr, 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 rrr?
It doesn't do anything. It's like it's got a suddenly dead battery.
Okay, all right. We're not prepared to jump into the security system if it sounds like it has a dead battery and there's no noise and nothing's happened. There's so many other places to go before we jump into the security system. You could have a bad starter solenoid. You could have a park neutral safety switch problem. You could have, on top of the steering column, when we come down, there's a big bulkhead connector, and that burns a lot of times. So there's lots of different places that you go. But I want to make a suggestion to you. If you go to marksalem.com, marksalem.com,
right,
and I want you to print out FAQ 28. And FAQ 28 is going to teach you to watch the headlights, and you're going to park against the garage door. So it's going to tell you, we want to know what the headlights are doing when you're experiencing the problem and when you're not. And all you have to do is be cognizant that you need to park against something where you can sit in the car and see the headlights. So you can park against a wall, you can park against your garage door, you can park against anything you want within 5 feet, just so you can see the headlights shine. But FAQ 28 will help guide you with respect to what's going on, because if it's trying to start the car, the headlights are going to dim slightly and come back on. If the starter's bad, the headlights are going to dim a lot and then come back on. So that's why I'm teaching you how to watch the headlights, and then you'll help us diagnose your car.
That is brilliant. Thank you. That will give us a place to start. I'm going to start taking notes of what's happening.
Yes.
When it does it.
If you take that FAQ 28 and you circle the areas that you can talk about, you'll save yourself some diagnostic money when you take it into the car repair shop, because they'll understand what we're trying to do. Thank you, Vicki. Thank you very much. 602-508-0960. We're going to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. 46 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem, and we're here live at Kurtz Auto Repair, I-17 and Bell. You just go east on Bell Road to 23rd Avenue, which is probably a block or two, and then you turn left at the light, and you'll pull right into the parking lot here at Kurtz Auto. You're welcome to stop by and talk to us, and if you have a car problem, we'll talk to you about your car problem, but we're not fixing any cars today. We're just going to help you gather the data that we need to fix your car. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Action Auto Repair. He's located just down the street, I-17 in Deer Valley. Tom at Action Auto Repair is a full-service, family-owned operation. He served the Deer Valley and the North Phoenix area since 1983. And so whatever your repair needs are, Tom and his staff are well-known for quality workmanship and good customer service and a fast turnaround time. And like many other shops, they have ASE Master Certified Technicians that really know how to diagnose your car and get the repair done right. So if you have any questions or problems and you live anywhere near I-17 in Deer Valley, then Action Auto Repair is a good place. I'll tell you what I like about Action Auto, Kurt. It's that you and him are within a couple of miles of one another, and you're friends and you work together.
That's because he's a good guy, and it's easy to be friends with a good guy, ain't it?
It is. So many different shops have a bad habit of hating everybody in their geographical area. They badmouth one another. They stand on one another's shoulders. But I've known you and Tom for many, many years, and that's just never happened between the two of you.
Well, when they're good people, Mark, it don't matter. We need all the good shops we can get. I don't care if they're next door to us, because there's, what, 4.5 million people, which puts 10 or 12 million cars. Me and you ain't going to make a dent and fix them.
Yeah, you're kind of right about that. All right, let's go to the phones real quick. Neil, good morning to you. How can we help you?
Yes, I have a 2015 Ram 2500 with a 6.4-liter engine, and I have two questions about the antifreeze and oil.
Okay.
The manual states to use 0W40 with a MS12633. Question is, how important is it to use oil that has the MS12633 stated on the label?
He's got a new Dodge Ram, a 15 Dodge Ram. It's got a 6.4 liter. Is that a diesel?
No, that's the Hemi.
That's the Hemi. Okay. So they want him to use a 0W40, and they've got a specification on that. The answer to your question, Neil, is you've got a specification there that nobody really goes by. The answer to your question is you should use a name brand 0W40. So Chevron, Valvoline. What do you pour here?
Okay.
Okay, a Valvoline
what about
brand.
The antifreeze. It calls for a OAT MS12106. Is that the same thing?
Well, the antifreeze is going to be more related to the color of the antifreeze. So there's all kinds of colors. Help me out. Blue, orange, amber.
Amber.
green, which is the old style. What's that one? There's red, and there's that one that's almost clear that a lot of the Europeans do.
Yeah.
But, so there's at least, what, seven different shades?
Right. And the key there is you have an oat coolant, O-A-T, and that tells you something about the coolant. So you get any oat compatible coolant at your auto parts store would be something that you could use. But I would strongly suggest that you do one of two things. You use the color of the coolant that's already in there, or you're going to use an amber general purpose all cover coolant. So you can use either one of those two. We have gone to the amber universal coolant for everybody in our fleet because we're tired of having 5, 6, and 7 different colors of coolant in inventory. So when you use the all-purpose, all-covering, all-encompassing amber coolant, then you're covering all the different cars. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're more than welcome, Neil.
But
when it comes to coolant, are you stocking coolant or are you buying coolant?
We stock the amber like you, and we use a lot of it. We stock some of the Dex Cools, and then we stock some green. But when we get into things like the Europeans, we buy, like if we have a Jaguar, a BMW, Mercedes, we buy specifically for that just because we don't want anybody coming back on that and fighting with us over whether or not that was what they called for. But we stock a lot of it and buy some of it.
And that is the problem with our industry. You put in a universal coolant made by Prestone, a well-known company. So 3 years later, the water pump fails.
Yeah.
And the technician in Oklahoma City tells them that we had the wrong coolant in there, and they bring back the repair bill for the water pump, the $200, $300, $400 water pump, and they've got this guy set their tail on fire and sent them back to you, and in reality, the water pump failed because the car has 110,000 miles on it, and it's leaking out of the weep hole, which means the back seal came apart or the back bearing started wallering out, and it has nothing to do with the coolant.
That is a problem, but if you use good product from people who you trust, if that does happen, you have them on your side and you have all the specifications needed, and you can fight that pretty good. But, yeah, that is a real problem.
So what happens here, Kurt, they show up and they don't have the old water pump but a picture of it, and they don't have any of the old coolant, so no one can test the coolant for combustion gases, for oil contamination and all that kind of stuff, but yet they want you to pay the $200 or $300 bill. Presents a problem, right?
That presents a problem. At that point in time, it goes into management, doesn't it? We have to decide, is this something we want to just see go away for a few $100, or is this something on principle that we're going to stand on what we know is right?
Okay, now there's another option. He or she can turn it into their insurance company if they have full coverage, which is on the comprehensive side. The comprehensive side says damage to my car by others.
Yes.
Okay? At the same time, that insurance company can deal with your insurance company, your garage liability insurance company, and the two of them can work it out. But in the absence of any evidence, those professionals would probably and typically understand that there's nothing here. Without a sample, a mayonnaise jar full of the old coolant, and without the water pump, we're really kind of difficult.
Yes. It's going to be a no. That's a no-win situation. It just is. There's nothing you're going to do to come out on top. So you just have to work it out to what works out best for all the whole situation.
I agree with you. And one of the considerations that you alluded to was, is this a first-time customer, or is this a customer that's got 40 work orders in my database?
Yeah, if it's 40 workers in the database and they want a couple $100, it's not even a problem. We'll take care of them.
And the other day we were dealing with one of our customers, and we have 38,000 customers in the number area. Okay, his number was 743.
Been there a while. Yeah, several years. Number 743 is definitely worth giving attention to.
Yeah, and in reality, what we did was is we had gone into our oldest customers and we had given them a discount in their file. And I had told him, I'm going to give you 10% on any ticket you choose. It's a bad idea to pick up an oil change.
Yes.
Because on an oil change for $35, I'm going to give you $3.50 back. So he had a situation where he had a bill for $2,000 or $3,000, and he said, can I use my 10%? I said, absolutely. Yes. That's what it's there for. So we have a caller on the line. Who have you got, Gil?
The caller, Terry.
Terry, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Yes, good morning, Mark. I've got a 2006 Toyota Camry,
and I'm having issues with the driver's side power window. Sometimes it will go, it'll go down, but it will not return, it will not go up no matter what I do. But if I shut the car off, restart the car, then it'll work just fine. Now, of course, it does it intermittently, you know.
Yeah.
So, but shutting the car off, it'll, it's like you reset it almost.
Okay.
Have you run across anything like that before?
No. What he's got is an 06 Camry, and on the passenger side of the car, the window, it'll go up. And sometimes it won't go up or down until he cycles the key. And then it will change and begin to operate properly. And that's not something I've ever heard of before, but it still doesn't make it difficult to diagnose.
No, and some of them Toyotas of that era have a window module on them, and sometimes it controls that module. I don't know if that one does, but we did run into a problem with a window module on a Toyota, and what happened was a bad motor had damaged some of the circuitry in the module, and it acted really weird like that. So if it's got a module, you'll have to check that. If it's not, it could be just a motor intermittently binding a switch, acting up and stuff. But the diagnosis shouldn't be that difficult on something like that.
Yeah, but shut it off.
I'm going to add to that.
Kind of reboots it almost.
Well, and you're right. There, it would be expensive to pull both door panels and swap modules if they're not dependent on a specific part of the car. The second thing you could do is I'm going to give you an option to do. Normally, the most used window is the driver's window. No question about that. But here's what I want you to do. When the car is acting up, and you said that the window would go, it would go down okay, but not go up?
Yes.
Okay. When it goes down and it won't go up, I don't want you to cycle the key. I want you to get out and walk around to the passenger side door. I want you to open up the door, and I want you to whack the door panel on the inside.
On the driver's side?
Oh, no, on the door where the window is acting up. Isn't that the passenger front?
Yeah, it's the driver's side that's on, yeah.
Okay, if it's the driver's side window that's acting up, that's the most used one. So the motor, like Kurt said, the motor is a real possibility. But I just want you to open up the door, and I want you to take your fist. Don't hurt anything, but just whack it, and then try the window again. Because if the motor is bad, and you whack the door panel good and hard, and it works two or three times, then again, you've saved yourself a lot of diagnostic money because you've really told us what we need to know. There's a bad connection or more than likely the motor. Real quick, let me tell you a story just about Terry. We're having lunch up north, and a bunch of my buddies, and they always tease me about being Mr. Genius Car Guy. So we walk outside, and a friend of mine, Daryl, complains that his Ford window won't roll up or down. So he says, you know, it's stuck down right now, and I said, I'll fix it for you for a dollar. And he goes, I'm not going to give you a dollar because you can't fix it for a dollar. And I said, okay, well, then don't. So we get outside, and somebody else says, I'll give you the dollar. So I said, okay, turn on the key. And he tries the window, and it doesn't work. So inside of the car, I hit that door panel hard, and the window went up and down. I took his buck, and I got on my motorcycle and drove away. and that's exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And I fixed a couple of doors by just whacking on the door. So, Terry, that's what I want you to do. We'll be back talking about cars. You're welcome to join us, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960.
That's 602-508-0960. Now, once again, here's Mark.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's 11 o'clock, 4 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem, and we're here at Kurt's Auto, and that's on Bell Road and 23rd Avenue. So you're just east of the I-17, just north of Bell Road, and you could stop by. And we've got Eric and Jeff and Kurt and Mark helping you out. So if you have a question, there's somebody here that can talk to you about it. And if you want someone to hit your door panel real hard to see if your window works, we're happy to do that too. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by IMM Auto Service. They've been fixing cars right and working on cars since 1972. So the question is why is IMM so special? Well, I'll tell you why. They work on cars that the rest of us don't want to work on. They specialize in Swedish, Italian, and Asian vehicles. So that includes Volvos and Saabs and Fiats and Alfa Romeos. We have a Saab that has the motor in 180 degrees off it should be. We've got Fiats out there that have technology that was born in the 40s. We've got Alfa Romeos out there that leak oil like there's no tomorrow. So that's what IMM service is all about. But here's the good news. No matter if you've got a Chevy or Ford, a Chrysler, a Honda, Toyota in your garage, they can do that too. So they can actually provide full service to you. But if you have a Saab, a Fiat, Alfa Romeo, they do those really, really well. So that's IMM Auto Service, the northeast quadrant of Tempe. They're south of the 202, just west of the 101. We're going to take a couple calls real quick. Chris, you're up first. How can we help you?
Yes, sir. I emailed about you this question about a month ago, but I want another opinion from you. I have more information. I have a 2003 Toyota Sienna, and I punctured the flex pipe on the exhaust side of the catalytic converter, and then I had the code P0430. I took it to an exhaust place, and they welded in another flex pipe. Reset the computer, the code came back on. I took it to a mechanic, and he said that it was definitely the catalytic converter. So I cleaned my battery terminals, new air filter, cleaned the mass airflow sensor, cleaned the throttle body, replaced the spark plugs, replaced the PCV valve, and now the check engine light has been off for probably 100 miles. Do you think it's going to pass emissions at this point?
Well, if the check engine light is off, then the answer is yes. It should pass emissions. If it comes on between now and the time you go through emissions, then you know it is.
Fixes that will usually fix it?
Well, you have to deal with it one at a time. What you have to understand is the code doesn't tell you what's wrong with the car. So it can have an O2 sensor code, but that doesn't say it needs an O2 sensor. Only 25% of the time at my shop do we put an O2 sensor in an O2 sensor code car. You'd be surprised that vacuum leaks and fuel filters that are plugged are really big problems that cause a lean and a rich condition that make O2 sensors look bad when they're really not. So I don't know. You know, you have to do some diagnostics on your car in order to find out. You have to talk to the computer. You say, well, what do you see? And it says, I see rich, or I see lean, or I'm not seeing a temperature on the front and the back on the catalytic converter that I want to see. So then you go in there and you find out why. Is the catalytic converter lighting or not? Does the front temperature sender, is it working? And we put a temperature gun on it, and we plug in our scanner, and it says, well, the inside is 600. Oh, on the outside, the temperature is 600 on the outside, but the sender is only reporting 200. Oh, so it's one of those. It's a temperature sender that's defective. So you those are cars you can't fix over the radio, but you've probably spent more time and money than we would have charged you. I talk about our industry, charged you to properly diagnose that.
I went to, like I said, a mechanic based on your recommendation, and I went to Real Nice Guy, obviously very credible, and he said it was definitely the catalytic converter. And I asked him how he knew that, and he says by the more intricate computers that you guys have.
Okay, what did he charge you?
That stuff anyway. You know, I needed to replace the rear spark plugs anyway, and I was back there anyway, so I just did the PCV valve.
What did he charge you for the diagnosis?
No, not at all. It's just a real expensive fix on this car.
All right. Okay, well, when you get a diagnosis and it costs you nothing, then that should tell you something. Even if it's one of my shops, it's just, I don't know what the conversation was like, but you got what you paid for. You got an educated guess, perhaps on looking through the problem through your eyes. So if we're looking through the problem with your eyes and we don't charge anything, then we're going to use the information you give us to the best of our ability.
Okay.
So if you see green and it's really red, then obviously we're going to go in the wrong direction. But, Chris, it shouldn't be any problem. If you'll get through emissions, it'll give you another year or two to deal with this. And if it comes on, you deal with it. And if it doesn't, you won't.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Chris. Thank you very much. Mike, you're up next. Can I help you?
Yes. I have a 2010 VW Jetta. And I'm having some intermittent air conditioning issues. So in weather like we have now, it works fine in post school. But whenever it gets warm or it gets really cold, it either doesn't blow cold air or it doesn't blow heat.
Okay. I heard that it doesn't blow cold. What from there?
Yes. So it's usually when it's really warm or when it's really cold. It doesn't blow either heat or cold.
Okay. So are you telling me the fan motor's not working, so nothing's coming out of the vents, period? It's not the temperature of the air you're concerned about. It's the volume of the air?
It's the temperature of the air.
Okay. Okay. Well, what has to happen on your VW is first of all, we have to go in and verify that it's capable of cold. So there's a low-pressure switch and a high-pressure switch on the car that's
right.
going to shut it down. So we have to make sure the compressor's moving. We have to make sure the nose of the compressor's moving. We have to hook up our gauges to see that we've got the low side right and the high side right. Maybe we'll throw some water on the condenser to see if that knocks down the high side. Maybe we suck all the Freon out of it and find out that you're supposed to have 30 ounces and you only have 18. So we put your 18 back in and then add another, 12 to it to get back to 30.
Right.
Those are the kinds of things that need to be done. Most shops are going to charge you for an air conditioning checkout and service under $100, depending on the amount of Freon you need. So
okay.
some of it can go more, some of it go. But here, let me give you the best advice I can. If I were you, I'd wait for another month. Not because it's going to save you any more money, but because when it gets, the temperature changes on a more solid basis, when we have, 5 days hot in a row, it's going
right.
to be a lot easier to diagnose that car than when we have 50-degree nights and 70-degree days.
Right. Definitely. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I know right now it blows cold air, but when it gets warmer, it'll be blowing hot air.
Yeah. And that's going to be kind of easy to diagnose because we're going to just interface and check the continuity through the high-pressure and low-pressure switch. And if one of those switches is turning it off, which is likely the low-pressure side, then the compressor is not going to spin. You're going to have air, but you're not going to have cold air. And the low side almost always means you're just low on Freon. How long ago did you have Freon serviced on this car?
I checked out the Freon last year, and the Freon was fine.
Okay.
I haven't checked it recently.
Okay. How did you check it?
With the a standard, the 134 Freon had a temperature gauge on it.
Okay. Yeah, there really is no dipstick for refrigeration.
Right.
But we have new equipment now that where we suck out your refrigerant and we clean it. And like I said, you have 18 ounces in it, and we know you have to have 30. So we add 12 more, and we put it back in, and now it starts to blow between 40 and 55 like it should all the time. So just servicing it and adding more Freon, we find lots of people that come in with 10 and 15 and 20 ounces over the amount the car holds.
Right.
And then it's easy at that point. We're just going to give you back 30 and keep 10 and charge you with the service, unless you want to put those 10 ounces in your pocket and carry them home. But that's probably what you need to do.
Okay.
All righty, Mike, thank you very much. We have one guest here in the studio with me right now. His name is Harry, and Harry calls sometimes, not always, but sometimes, and I can always remember his voice, and I remember two things about Harry. Harry is a good listener and a good talker, but he's also a fireman. Is that right?
Retired firefighter.
And where from?
Phoenix.
Phoenix. Mm-hmm. So you've been in Phoenix, and how many years did you put in as a firefighter?
About 31.
31 years. And what was the best job you did, and what was the worst job you had?
Well, the best was an engineer. I was an engineer for quite a while. The worst. I don't know. It really wasn't a worst job. It was just a good job.
What, did you kill anybody when you were cooking?
I didn't cook. They always had some good cooks, so I was kind of, I just washed the dishes.
Okay, so as an engineer, are you driving or are you directing?
Well, I'm driving. The captain is the one that directs.
Okay. And where's he sitting? Is he sitting next to you?
Yes, definitely.
And so did you ever pile that big fire truck into anything that you shouldn't have?
No. Had a few scrapes, so no big accidents.
All righty. And then once you got there, what was your job?
Well, it depended on what kind of call it was.
Hey, let's pretend it's a house fire.
Okay. Well, you gotta make sure you got water, and you got to get the pump going because they're going to be pulling lines off to attack the fire. And then you got to take care of your water supply and then make sure you got an adequate water supply and communications because your command's going to be talking to you and, possibly and want to know what's going on. So. There's a lot of different things going on, kind of.
So let me get this straight. You're kind of in the middle because you got the command in your left ear, You got everybody else in your right ear, and it's your job to make it all meet in the middle. Is that a good explanation?
Well, if the water supply stops, then it's really a bad thing. It's my job just to keep the water supply going and everything and get them to the right address. Of course, the supply. That's the main thing.
I would imagine that years and years ago when you started, GPSs and that kind of stuff weren't available. You had to know. So let me ask you this. The odd numbers are on what side of an east and west street?
The odd numbers are on south and east.
And I'll tell you what, a million people out of a million people don't know that.
Right.
And on the south side of an east and west street are the odd numbers. And then on a north and south side, it's the east side. So the east and the south are the odd numbers. So when you drive down the street and you're looking for 1025, it's going to be on the south side of the street.
Right, that's correct. The only mess up is Grand Avenue. It runs at a diagonal, so some places it can be different.
But, Harry, there's a lot of people out there thinking to themselves, why don't you just go find the smoke?
Well, that's always the easiest, but that's not always what happens, you know.
You're a good sport to let me tease you. You're a good sport to let me tease you. Thanks for stopping by. Oh, that's okay. And we just want to tell you that Harry's, like you said, he's a caller. He's a fireman. And as the engineer, I would imagine that you probably were the lightning rod of the fire kind of, the visit or the job, right?
Well, not necessarily. Usually the captain, or you might have a fire. It depends on what kind of truck you're on.
Okay.
You know, if you're on a truck, which is a ladder, a little bit different. The engines are a little bit different, and then you have your rescue trucks and whatever. Each one's a little bit different. Then you have multi-company stations, and then stations that just, when I first came on, just had an engine, and that was it.
So how is it that you never had to cook? Because my impression is that the firehouse, everybody takes chance. Were you the dishwasher, and you passed on the cooking?
Well, no. When I first started, they tell you, okay, it's your turn to cook, and you kind of try to figure out what's a good menu, what everybody likes, and then if you survive that, of course, in the old days, the old timers really rode you hard if you didn't put out a good meal. But a lot of stations had a kind of a permanent cook, so they did the cooking, you help preparation, and of course, washing the dishes and cleaning it up. So.
Well, it's a good thing I wasn't a fireman, Harry, because if we would, we would have had peanut butter and jelly the whole time. All righty, 17 minutes after the hour, 18 minutes after the hour, and we're going to take a break. If you'd like to join us, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. My name is Mark Salem, and we're here at Kurt's Auto, and that's on Bell Road and 23rd Avenue. So if you go north on Bell, north on the I-17, you turn right on Bell and you go to 35th Avenue. You turn left, and Kurt's is right there. We're here talking about cars. You're welcome to join us. You're welcome to stop by. We've got Eric here, and Jeff, and Kurt, and Mark Salem, and one of us will talk to you about your car problem. There's no guarantee we're going to be able to fix your car problem, but what we can do is we can have you be our eyes and our ears so you can help us, and we can help you understand what it is that you need to look for and you need to tell us. Because if you can participate in the repair, it's going to save you some diagnostic money. I can virtually assure you of that. Speaking of diagnostic money, one of the best diagnosticians in town is at Larry Harker's Auto. Bob there is a trusted name for auto repair, and Larry Harker's has been around since 1967. So Larry Harker's is well known for fast, affordable service. They do auto electrical work. They do brake service, auto emissions, vehicle maintenance. But they're really, really good at tracking down the really tough problems. Sent him a Dodge truck not too long ago with two different problems, and Bob was able to find and fix both of them to the customer's satisfaction. So along with Jeff and Eric, who sit with me right now, and I have to kind of say that, Bob at Larry Harker's is certainly one of the top three guys in town that's a good diagnostician. They're at 38th Avenue and Indian School, Larry Harker's Auto Repair. Jeff, we're going to take a call real quick, so just hang tight with us, and let's go to Tim. Tim, good morning. How can I help you?
Hi, good morning, Mark. 2006 Toyota Tundra. I'm going to do a power steering flush on it, and they have various power steering fluids. One of them happens, excuse me, to be made by Valvoline, and it's high mileage, and that's, let's say, in excess of 100,000 miles. I have no runs, no drips, no errors. I mean, the power steering is fine. It's just time to do it. Would it make sense to do the over the high mileage power steering fluid, and in the long run, it would be more of a preventive also in terms of seals and stuff?
Okay, well, what color is the fluid that you have in there?
I would say that it's a clear to a very light beige.
So it's clear to a light. It's not red, and it's not black.
No, red.
Okay. How are you going to top it off, or are you going to flush it yourself?
No, I'm going to have it done professionally.
Okay, you're going to have somebody else do it?
Correct.
Okay. I think you let the shop make that decision because we all have different options. Some guys are going to want to go back with the Toyota power steering fluid. Some guys are going to want to go back with just it. And keep in mind, the power steering fluid is just simply a hydraulic fluid.
Right.
So we're going to pump it under pressure, and we're going to return it on the return line. So it's going into the rack at hundreds of pounds, and it's coming back at 20 or 30 pounds. So. And then you also have those high mileage. I want to tell you that my personal opinion about the high mileage fix everything, make you feel warm and fuzzy and make your car love you, that's not one of my favorite things. I think that's a marketing strategy. I think most of those guys are marketing to somebody that's in the 75 and north range, 75,000 and north range. And I think that there's probably four or five different options that you have. But I think you need to look at the shop owner and you say to him, What did you put in your wife's car? And I think that'll tell you all you need to know. If he's using the universal, then that would be a good one to do. All righty?
Yeah, essentially he told me just to put in the regular fluid and not to go with the high mileage. And I was just curious, what do they put some kind of additive in that high mileage that's supposed to stop leaks?
Well, the high mileage power steering fluid, it would be nice if they did tell us what was different. It would be nice if they did tell us why their high mileage fluid was better than any of the rest of them that we have on the market, but they don't do that.
Right.
And then when they start talking, they say this: well, with high mileage fluid, your pump's going to love us more, and your hoses are going to deteriorate a little less, and our fluid actually makes your pump run cooler. And all of that is not true, because the power steering in your car is directly, the performance of it is directly related to how you're using it. So if you pull into a Safeway parking lot and you turn the steering wheel all the way to the right and you sit there and do circles for 20 minutes, that power steering fluid is going to get warm, and their
right.
fluid's not going to be any better than anybody else's. So, and then they talk about scrubbing bubbles. Well, our high mileage, our power steering fluid or our oil is going to clean your car up. There's no such thing as scrubbing bubbles. We can take an old engine with 100,000 miles, and the only thing we can do to clean that engine out is fill it full of gasoline or solvent.
So
and run it for a few minutes,
advantage.
And then drain it, and run it, and drain it, and run it.
For preventative maintenance, I'm putting a high mileage in there.
Yeah. So I'm if your shop owner says that he doesn't like the high mileage and he just wants to use regular power steering fluid, I'm on his side.
All right.
Thank you. And we have somebody else, Gil?
That's right. We're going to go from one Tim to another Tim.
Oh, okay. Tim number two, how can we help you?
Hi, thank you. Thanks so much for taking my call. Appreciate it. I'm in the middle of a conundrum now. I have a 2015 Volvo XC70. And about 2 months ago, I was coming to a, cruising to a stop at a light off the freeway, and it started to miss, and my engine light went on. So I took it into a specialty mechanic, Volvo Saab specialty mechanic. He had it for 10 days, couldn't figure it out, told me to take it to a dealer. I took it to the Volvo dealer. They had it for about a week. He tells me it's a $2,300 fix. And the fix was to change the, to replace the fuel injectors, six of them. And it was kind of incredulous to me to have all six fuel injectors go bad at the same time, but I figured he's the expert, so.
Okay, well, did it fix the car?
So he calls me, and I come pick up the car, pay him the $2,300. He tells me that the repair is guaranteed for life, and go to any Volvo dealer, yada, yada. So I take it out and drive about 10 miles to my house, and the same thing happens.
Okay.
So I turn around, take it back. He keeps it for another 10 days, does something else to it, said he cleaned something, you know, calls me again, come to pick it up, drove it for that evening. The next day, the same thing happens again.
Okay.
I take it back.
Okay, we need to get to the end of this story, though.
Yeah, the end of the story is they change the catalytic converter. They tell me that it's okay. I go pick the car up.
Okay. All right, well, I'm gonna put you on hold because I'm about 40 seconds away from the end of the break, and I'm going to talk with Jeff about this. But the story you tell is the ugliest part of our industry. And clearly, you know, and everybody else knows, that they're guessing. And they're guessing with your money. And I hope you paid with a credit card, because unless you ask for your old parts back and you paid with a credit card, there's a good chance that you're not going to get made whole again. But when we come back, we're going to have some ideas for you. So just stay right there. 602-508-0960. We're at Kurtz Auto, 23rd Avenue and Bell on the north side of the road. You can stop by if you'd like. Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. We're here at Kurtz Auto at Bell Road, just east of the I-17, 23rd Avenue, just north. So if you're in that area and you're driving around, you want to stop by, Jeff's here to talk to you. Eric is, Kurt, and Mark Salem, me. We'll sit here and talk to you about your cars. So you're welcome to stop by. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Automatic Transmission Exchange. They've been in Phoenix since 1968. They do transmission repairs and replacements, but they're really, really good at fixing the old and the new. They've gone to the next level because they actually have a dynamometer now that they can put your new rebuilt transmission on it and thoroughly test its operation before they install it in their car. That saves a lot of time. If we have a leak or if we have a problem, we can fix it before we put it in your car. They're located at 40th Street in Washington. They're now open Saturdays from 8 to 12 for your convenience. Those of you that go up and down Washington on the north side of 40th and Washington, you'll see a place that's been there again since 1968. Okay, to recap real quick, Jeff, we've got a gentleman on the phone, Tim, that took in this 15 Volvo, and it dies and stalls intermittently. So the very first thing they did is evidently five of the six fuel injectors. Now, I want you to describe what the typical symptoms are for a bad fuel injector. Just one, a bad fuel injector.
Yeah, so Mark, usually if we have a bad fuel injector, we're going to have a misfire, roughness, across all ranges. Usually it's consistent, and it goes, if you're losing fuel, you're going to have it consistently across the board.
And what you mean by that is from idle all the way to 50, 60, 70, and if it'll do 80 miles an hour, it's good, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right?
Generally speaking, that is correct.
Okay. So a bad fuel injector just doesn't cause it to die?
No, not unless it flat shorts out and draws down the power to like a control module. That's kind of a far-reaching. We don't see that on a regular basis.
And if it was that bad, it would still be throughout the entire range of speed and RPM.
Correct. If it shorts out, it doesn't matter where you're at, it's going to shut it down.
Okay. So then he goes in and they put a catalytic converter in. What is the possibility that a catalytic converter is going to allow a car to die and restart and drive fine for some short period of time?
Yeah, I've never seen a catalytic converter cause a stalling concern. I've seen it make it so it won't get out of idle, run terrible, but I've never seen a catalytic converter cause a stall.
And see, the catalytic converter, for the folks that are listening, is the device that's hooked to your exhaust system, and what we do is we get it glowing bright red, so any of the fuel that comes out of the engine is consumed by the catalytic converter, and hopefully what comes out of the tailpipe is clean air. So the catalytic converter, when it melts down inside, it plugs the exhaust. So you run out of power. You're on your way to Flagstaff, and you run out of power, and all you can do is just 21 miles an hour with your foot to the floor. Those are the kinds of symptoms associated with a catalytic converter. And then after they did the catalytic converter and five or six of the injectors, then they did spark plugs. And spark plugs for a dying and stalling problem are just like fuel injectors. It's a wide range, right?
Correct. Again, if you're assuming to have all six or spark plugs still at the same time, again, the chance of that, you have a better chance of getting struck by lightning 17 times in a row. It just doesn't happen. You can maybe have one fail, which would cause a misfire, but not likely at all to stall an engine.
And there would be so many others. Let's pretend that he has 150,000 miles and he's never replaced his spark plugs. He would intermittently die and stall. He'd have poor fuel economy. And he certainly would have a really rough acceleration. And that's because of all the spark plugs are worn, right?
Correct. Correct. I mean, it'll affect a bunch of performance concerns, but generally not stalling.
And it's likely to turn on the check engine light if we have a continuous misfire in a spark plug or something like that.
Yes, that is correct.
And the injector is the same way. When you have an injector and we're running lean on one cylinder and the contribution of that one cylinder is no longer there when it looks for it, oftentimes we'll get a different code with a misfire for a number cylinder, two or three or four.
Yeah, absolutely. But usually there's a check engine light and a code or a direction that correlates with your misfire, with whatever's bad, whether it be an injector or spark plug. And it'd be a surprise to me if we're stalling and not have some sort of code or direction to go to.
But it's possible. It's possible. So here's the deal, Tim. I teach women and men to, when they go to their auto repair shop, they're supposed to say to the shop, I'm not paying for guessing. And you look them in the eye and you say, whatever you say, I'm going to pay for, but it better fix my problem. Because if it doesn't fix my problem, I don't want to pay for it. If you're going to guess with my money, you need to tell me you're guessing with my money. And there are certain times that we will guess with your money, but we tell you that in advance. I don't know why your fan motor's not working, but I want to replace the fan motor. I don't know if that's going to fix it, but it's a $120 guess, but that's all I can find. So if you want me to guess, I'll do that. It's $120. But I'm not giving you your money back because I'm telling you right from now it's a guess. Tim, clearly they're guessing with your money. They guessed on the fuel injectors. It made no difference. If you can truly say it made no difference after the injectors were replaced, the catalytic converter was replaced, and the spark plugs were replaced, then in reality, what you have to do is you have to go back to them and you say to them, I want all my money back. And if you paid with a credit card and they say no, you can stop payment on all those credit cards. Or you could take it to another dealer and you say to the other dealer, some shop over on the other side of town did all this work. That'll raise their hackles a little bit, and you don't tell them it's another dealership, and see if they can fix it. But you treat them the same way. You look them in the eye, and you say to them, I'm not paying for guessing. If you're going to call me and tell me exactly what you found wrong that causes my car to die and stall, and I want to see you write that on the repair order, it's dying and stalling, but it restarts immediately, and I can continue on for some period of time. It seems to die and stall when I'm coming to a stop. The engine will fall on its face and die, but as soon as I put it into neutral and start it back up, I can accelerate, and I can go 70 or 100 miles an hour. That's the kind of conversation you need to have, because none of what you've had done, the spark plugs, the fuel injectors, the catalytic converter, match the scenario I just said. So it's 40 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. 44 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock. We're here at Kurtz Automotive, Kurtz Auto, and we're on Bell Road just east of the I-17. You get to 23rd Avenue, you take a left, and Kurt and I and Eric and Jeff are all here at your service. We even have a diesel expert, David from Southwest Diesel. He stopped by. He's probably on his third meal by now. I'm looking outside to see if he's around. Anyway, we've got Bill on the line, but before I talk about Bill, I want to tell you about Air Park Auto Service. Nadine and Stacy owned Air Park Auto Service in North Scottsdale in 1985. They're located on Raintree, just east of Hayden, and Raintree is just south of Bell or Frank Lloyd Wright Boulevard. They're still family-owned and operated, although Stacy's passed, but Nadine still runs the shop. That should be kind of an advantageous thing for the ladies who want to patronize a female-oriented shop that's been around more than a year or two. So again, they've been around a very long time, since 1985. Air Park Auto is a state-of-the-art clean and green facility. They have the very latest diagnostic tools, and they know what services the different makes and models of vehicles and small trucks that you have need. So if you live in the North Scottsdale area, I know you'll be happy with the service you receive at Air Park Auto. All righty, we're going to go to Bill. And, Bill, what I'm going to do is hand the phone to Eric or Jeff. I get you guys mixed up, and I apologize. You don't even look alike. I know that he has horns and you don't, so he's a little ornery. But anyway, Bill, here's Jeff, and Jeff, here's Bill.
Bill, how can we help?
Hi, Jeff, I've got a suspension question for you.
Mm-hmm.
2000 Chevy Silverado half-ton two-wheel drive, 203,000 miles on it. I plan on keeping the truck for for another 17 years,
mm-hmm.
but my front end is completely shot.
Okay.
I'll be having everything rebuilt up front. I'd like to level the truck.
Got it.
Apparently, my options are a spindle kit that will raise it, adding a spacer, or putting in a taller aftermarket or factory four-wheel drive leaf springs, or excuse me, coil springs.
Yeah.
What is your advice?
Okay. How do you use the truck?
The truck is a daily driver. I live on about 4 miles of bad dirt road. That's what's caused my front end issues.
Got it. And you, do you pull loads or anything like that? Or
nothing heavy, no.
Nothing heavy. So if you're talking, yeah, obviously some of, you start adding spacers, it will typically make the ride harsher. If you go with like your coil spring kit, I'm assuming you said it was tool drive. I'm sure there's a coil spring on the front.
Correct.
If you get like a progressive rate coil spring, they'll give you a little more height. Usually that's the best ride quality. But again, explore your options. There's definitely different brand names, and do a lot of research. You're talking aftermarket, you know, suspension modifications. You any input on this one, Mark?
Hey, Bill. I understand what the situation is, but I think from risk and cost, you're far better to just fix your front end. So if you need upper and lower control arm bushings, or if you need some ball joints or whatever, pitman arms and tie rod ends and stuff like that, just go ahead and do that. If the suspension is sagging, then a set of springs I would agree to. I would agree to that. But here's the risk. Everybody has a different opinion on two things, leveling and rebuilding. There's lots of folks that want to level your truck, but they tell you after it's done that, oh, yeah, the nose is 2 inches, but it'll settle, and oftentimes it never settles. And a lot of times the way they lift the truck is put big rubber spring rubbers underneath the springs that you have right now, and there is a certain amount of time that those will collapse. Probably not in your 203,000-mile range, but they will collapse. And if you have a motor that leaks oil and those spring saddles that are made out of rubber end up covered with oil, that creates a problem as well. So I would think what would be best for you is just fix whatever's bad. So if you have, have you been told specifically what's failed on your front end?
Yeah, the upper and lower A-arms, ball joists, tie rods, I'm going to have the complete front end rebuilt. And while it's apart, I'm looking at leveling the truck.
Okay. So why wouldn't it just be, after you've been around the world 8 times, why wouldn't we just put a new set of springs on the front and bring the nose up?
Well, that was my question. What would be the best route to go?
Yeah, that would be the least riskiest and the most advantageous for this reason. There's going to be a savings in labor if we're taking the upper and lower control arms off that thing to load the spring back on it, because basically you're just going to pay for the springs. There's no additional labor. So that's kind of a good thing. And obviously, if you're going to buy springs, you can buy a variety of springs, but I'd be looking at something that was considerably that looked and felt like the OEM springs that came out. Now, General Motors isn't the only guy in the world, because they don't even build those springs. They buy them from somebody else. So you call 5 or 6 different parts stores, or have your shop give you 5 or 6 different options, and then you look the owner or the head guy in the face and say, what would you put on in your truck? One of the other things, it just depends on how droopy the front end is. For a couple of inches, that wouldn't be a really big deal. But if you want to raise it up 4 inches or 5 inches, that's going to be a big deal. And when you do that, you're going to throw the geometry of the front end completely out. Somebody's going to have to go in there and realign it, and you can't use the specifications that came with the truck. So they're going to have to be a gray-haired son of a gun, and they're going to have to know alignments in order to bring you back to where you need to be. So I understand
I'm just looking at probably 1.5 inches, 2 inches at the most.
Okay.
Just to make the truck look level.
Okay.
It's just cosmetics is all it is.
Okay. Well, have you got a pencil and paper handy?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay, 480-598-1234, ask for Alan. And here's the question. I've got a Silverado two-wheel drive with 203,000 miles. I need the front end rebuilt. Tell me what kind of springs you would put in that to bring the nose up 1 or 2 inches. He does that every day. So he might be able to give you a brand like Moog or something like that with some progressive springs like Jeff was talking about, where we're kind of soft on the top end of the spring, but when we start compressing it a lot, it firms up the ride a lot. And that's, most people like that progressive spring. So you call Alan and ask him what he'd put in there, and I think he'll give you a good idea on the springs. The rest of the stuff, the ball joints and the tie rod ends, I don't know. What front end parts do you sell? Do you have a brand that you like?
No, we prefer Moog, Raybestos, Premium Chassis.
Okay. So he's with me, Raybestos, Premium Chassis, and Moog. I usually sell Moog, but Raybestos is also a good name brand for chassis, so, and ball joints and upper control arms, lower control arms, and all the stuff you're talking about. So we just find it, we find Moog to be a real premium product, and it's not at a premium price. So that's the answer. Bill, thanks for calling. If you have anything else, here's my email address, and it's mark@marksalem.com, and that goes for anybody. If you have a car question, you're always welcome to email me your car question at mark@marksalem.com. And, Bill, if you want to pick between a couple of parts that you find that you like, then I'll pass it on to Jeff, and we'll discuss it right in front of you, and then you'll have a better answer. And we'll probably put Alan in there as well. He's a little younger than we are, but we think that we can digest everything. So anyway, thank you very much for calling, Bill. And
gentlemen, thank you.
You're welcome. Gil?
Lines are open.
Lines are open. So, Jeff, here's your chance to talk about Eric. Now, Eric is the lead tech at Kurtz Automotive. Eric, his chest is puffed a tad. He says that the, I think he said, now I'm not real sure, but I think he said the shop revolves around him, that he's the sun of the shop and everybody else is the planet. So I'd like to know what you think about me just throwing him under the bus.
You know, Mark, how can I say anything bad about God's gift to technicians? No, all serious, Eric's a good guy, and I'm just going to, it doesn't matter what he says bad about me. He's our most decorated soldier. He's certified. He just about has every light duty certification there is to have through ASC. He's good at what he does. What can I say?
Well, you also have ASC certification.
I do. I'm an ASC master certified technician and a certified service consultant. Regardless of what Eric says about me, I still know who I am. I'm good.
Well, I think you have two different jobs. You have to do two jobs. You have two hats. Number one, you've got to talk to the customer to get the most information out of the customer to help the technicians diagnose their car, right? And because you're an ASC master, you know when they come in with a vibration to ask them, does it shake the steering wheel or the seat of your pants? So you have a big advantage from most service writers who clearly are paper pushers and they don't have the skills necessary. So you do that. Now, you also have skills. So when the guy comes to you and says, this car has a dyno and stalling problem, and I want to put a catalytic converter on it, you can handle that, right?
Yes, I can. So that I think that's job number one. I think this job number two is that changing all the guys in the shop's diapers, the running an adult daycare center. That includes Eric, too, by the way.
So Eric wears diapers. Is that what I hear you say?
Yeah, and they're usually full. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, when the delay hits the crowd outside, they're going to go crazy. Anyway, no, and I admire you. I wish that everybody in the service industry had the skills you have, because we wouldn't have the disconnect. You know, on that Volvo we were just talking about, the guy takes the car and he's got an intermittent dyno and stalling problem, and they put a catalytic converter, there's fuel injectors and spark plugs in it. There's a disconnect between what they're writing down and the technician is just not paying attention. So there's a problem there, and that wouldn't necessarily, I would bet that doesn't happen with you, because when the technician comes back to you and says it needs a cat, you kind of know better.
Yeah, if you got a guy stalling and somebody says he needs a cat on a stalling concern, I'm going right back out of the shop saying, guys, apparently we misunderstood here. It doesn't need a cat because the car stalled. Let's rethink this and go back to the drawing board. Let's get some real solutions for the customer.
And it's a good idea. We do the same thing. We get two or three guys together and say, okay, you three senior guys, go help this junior guy. Go look at what he said. He's going off on this catalytic converter. Now, every once in a while, maybe once in a year or so, they'll come back and say, he was right. He was right for the wrong reason, but he was right. And what I hear is that's a guess.
That's correct. And at that point in time, we buy him lunch, I guess.
Yeah. No, you're right. Right. We still have to tell him he hit it right, but we just can't tell him that is that family?
Yep. I got Logan outside.
Okay.
That's my boy.
Okay. And is he interested in cars?
He loves it. He's building Lego boats and trucks this morning when I left to come here.
All righty. Is he in the Boy Scouts? Are you and him going to partner up on the Boy Scouts with those derby cars?
I don't know about the derby cars, but we definitely go outdoors a bunch. He's an outdoorsman at 9 years old. So.
All right. Good for you. Good for you. That's a lot better than, can you imagine how bad it would be to be Eric's kid?
Oh, man, you'd be stuck, you know, what, playing with PAs and stuff like that, reading Lego magazines at 27. I don't know.
Well, we have to get even with him because the first 20 or 30 minutes he sat in here and he beat up everybody else. So we're just getting even with him. That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
All righty. If you live up north, anywhere near I-17 and Bell, Kurtz Automotive is a good place. I wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't tell you that if I didn't truly believe that. Kurtz is an honest facility. Kurtz owns and operates Kurtz Auto. Jeff is his service writer, and you won't find a service writer with the master technician level. So he knows if the technicians are telling him the truth or not. Then you've got Eric out in the shop, and Eric is a master tech with a variety of other certifications, and frankly, probably five or six he has, I don't have, but maybe two of them. So he's well-skilled, and he's been certified. That means he's taken tests, and they have identified that he has the necessary skills to work on cars. So there's about four or five different kinds of technicians, and you've got what we call the oil change guys. Those are the light-duty guys. Those are the guys that do tire repairs, tire rotations. They're going to strip a lug nut every once in a while. The shop can take care of it, but hopefully they're going to grow to the next level. And then we have what we call the R&R guys, take it off and put it on. That's the water pump guys. That's the alternator guys and the starter guys. And typically they're supervised by a more senior technician. And then you get into just a kind of a heavy line technician. And the heavy line guys that does differentials and transmissions and does, we talked about just a few minutes ago with one of the guys, I think it was Bill, who wanted to rebuild his front end. That's kind of the heavy line guy. And then you've got the master tech. And the master tech is somebody who's well-skilled in all of those different arenas and can help the other guys as well as lead the other guys. And that's kind of how it's important. So if you live up here, Kurtz Auto at I-17 and Bell's a good place. My name is Mark Salem. My email address is mark@marksalem.com. If you have any questions, you can always email me. And if you leave a phone number, I'll call you back. I hate to type, so it's easier for me to just call you. I'll see you next Saturday.